Welcome.
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 You're listening to Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Built by Us. Hey everyone, welcome back to a brand new episode of Built by Us. It's Taylor and Alyssa here again, and we are continuing our series of highlighting movement makers here in North Carolina, which I'm really excited about. And we have another really special guest with us today, Taylor, who is here.
I'm very excited that we are joined by Ngaza Laughing House. He is someone who I've been working with in our various equity spaces, so it is great for us to be joined here today. Ngaza, would you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, most definitely. Well, thank you guys for having me on the podcast, man. This is a dope little event, man. I feel good and special being up here with y'all, so thank y'all. My name is Ngaza Laughing House, like you said, Taylor. I'm a local organizer and a lawyer, too. I really like the organizing work more than I do anything else, so I found a way to infuse both together. So yeah, grew up in Raleigh, been doing movement work pretty much my whole life.
So I think you will be our first lawyer on this series. So how did you come to law? And then what was your journey with deciding that organizing was maybe a little bit more important? Yeah.
Yeah. So how did I come to law? When I got out of undergrad, I couldn't find a job doing much of anything because the economy had just went bad back in 2008. So I was working in grocery stores. I was working at a mail room, in call centers, doing every little thing. And I hated that stuff, man. I knew I could get fired at any moment. So I figured I'd just go to law school, man. It'll be covered in the storm of the economic crisis and everything. So I went to law school and I came out and took the bar, passed it, happened to get my law license, just held on to it since then. Never actually planned on being a lawyer. It was never my grand aspiration. I just didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. So I said, shoot, I'll be a lawyer. So I did that and I came out and I started working at the public defender's office in Durham. And I can go on for days about what that was like. Man, it wasn't bad as people think it would be in the sense that my clients didn't get on my nerves. I love my clients to death, but I couldn't stand the judges. I couldn't stand that whole system. Like when I'm in that dealing with and representing clients who people that I would be kicking it with outside of the job. So these are brothers and sisters that I'd be hanging out with in the neighborhood, in the barbershop, playing basketball with, just coming around, kicking it with, seeing on the weekends. But in court, all of a sudden, I got to represent them. And I'm standing there and to see a judge talking down on them, or to see the judge call the jail line, and everybody in the jail line is a Black person, one of my brothers or sisters. It just tore me up on the inside. So I couldn't stay there for much longer. So I left that and I started doing criminal justice reform work. And that slowly led me to ACLU right now.
And how long have you been at the ACLU at this point?
I've been here for about a year and 2 months now.
And what do you do at the ACLU?
Yeah, so I'm working as the field manager at the ACLU. You know, the ACLU works in the legal system, in the courts, in the legislature, the General Assembly, and then in the community too, all pushing forward a progressive agenda. And it's my job just to bring all of the other things we do to our community and pull our community, get them involved in the movement too. So I'm working as a field manager right there.
Yeah, that's cool. I feel like I always hear of ACLU on like a really big scale, large way. And I don't really think about all the work that they do like in their individual like ACLUNC, ACLU, like all their different individual chapters and stuff.
That's right. That's right. And it's important that we just don't adopt that typical nonprofit do-gooder savior type model too. So we're striving in the work that I do. I like to dig deep into Black and brown working class communities. Not going up there to provide some services, but are organizing in the truest sense of the form, organizes people, pulls them into organizations. So every time I go to groups, I like to set up their own local organizations in that community, recruit people to come and join that organization, and then tie that organization back into the network, back into the movement. Still doing my job for the ACLU, but building power. And another thought on that too, is that we never know when our times come and go at these nonprofits. Like nonprofit, the funding might change, the directors might change, they might decide we don't wanna do certain types of work anymore. They might start treating me bad, so I got to leave and find another one. But we don't want our work to end when we leave the nonprofit, when the nonprofit directors change their mind. So that's why it's so important to be building community groups that no matter what, they can be independent, they can last even when you're gone from your job. So that's what I always strive to do, building independent organizations.
Yeah, one of the questions we've been asking our guests is, what is your personal theory of change? And it sounds like you just said that a little bit, but would you want to you know, say specifically what your personal theory of change is and how you do work.
Yeah, most definitely. So my theory of change is that there's no power without organization, and oppressed people have to be organized. Like, you think back to the time when we were slaves, we had nothing else. We had no legal rights, no money, couldn't even read. But the one thing we did have was our ability to organize other people in similar situations and resist like that. So it's unfortunate when I'm talking in front of groups and I ask the audience, who here is a part of any type of political organization, Black political organization? And a lot of times people in the audience don't raise their hand. They're not a part of anything, which is crazy to me. When we know that organization is power, that's why the other side is always organized. So when I was working at Harris Teeter, they had annual meetings with the managers, the big conferences, association with store managers that met once or twice a year. And they were doing that because they wanted to maintain their power. They know it's power in us being organized and making sure these workers don't try to form unions. But on the flip side, let us decide we wanted to have annual meeting of workers and workers organization across the state. They would try their hardest to stop that because they know that's what gives us power. And even at a local level, when you go in some affluent neighborhoods, some white neighborhoods, every time there's something happening in that neighborhood that the residents don't like, you'll see old white ladies, 80 years old, they'll get together, they'll go to the city council meetings and they'll say, we want a stop sign, put at this intersection right here. So even they understand the power of coming together, of being organized. And if you're not organized, then you have no chance of influencing a levian power.
I'm glad that you said it in that way. That's so, like, obviously as an organization, we believe that making sure that everyone comes together is necessary because, you know, it's something that's talked about a lot. Like, your one voice by yourself may not get heard. But if all of your voices together, you know, it's like a cliche for a reason, right?
That's yeah. Exactly right.
We've had a lot of guests that have come up here and been like, a political home is one of the most important parts of building something together. So definitely.
That's right. And even like other organizers too, another just woke, socially conscious people. You can study all the political theory you want. You can have every detail, every bit of history down in your head, the sharpest political analysis. But if you ain't building an organization, then what are you doing with it? Like, how are you burning that into power? So we always have to be building organizations. Even Malcolm X, even Fred Hampton, Fannie Lou Hamer, the sharpest among us understand the power and the importance of doing that physical, on-the-ground work of recruiting people, building organizations. So that's what we got to do. You're never too big to build an organization.
Would you say there's what would you say around that you're most proud of that's going on right now in your work?
Ooh, in my work. So it's most definitely my work with Refund Raleigh. I love this young group to death. I love it to death.
Ajamu was telling us about Refund Raleigh.
Yeah, refundraleigh.org. So it's amazing because after all the protests that happened last year in summer 2020, so we saw everybody flooding the streets and we knew there was going to be an outcry of support, of interest, of excitement in that moment. But in the months after that is where that energy oftentimes will wane out and die out. The important thing is getting through that period where the interest and excitement dies out to still maintain your steady local work. So we know that organizing is a long, slow process, especially if you dig in deep in communities. And from there, everybody's going to come out when the cameras are around, when George Floyd is happening, to Breonna Taylor, everybody is out in front of the cameras, then posting everything on social media. But in the years since then, the fact that Refund Raleigh has continued to do work, uplifting the campaign, tying the campaign into real life working class struggles right now, has been amazing. So tying the effort to divest from police back into raising the minimum wages and the zero fare public transportation. So we want to take that money and put it back into the community. So it's been amazing to work with this young group and see everything that they're doing and all the stuff that we're accomplishing.
That's great. I just want to make sure that all of our listeners after this look up Refund Raleigh, check out their work, check out Ajamu's resources that he's made there. And are y'all taking contributions or Refund Raleigh taking contributions?
We take whatever people got. All most right. Importantly, like, we want contributions of people actually getting out there with this, building, organizing in your neighborhoods where you're at, and pulling us out there to help you too. So yeah, whatever people can give.
So Raleigh friends, show up and go work with Refund Raleigh.
So we have a big question that Des actually came up with, Des Gatewood. We've been asking all of our movement makers because it's just something important to think about. We're not maybe looking for a really like tangible answer, but just your thoughts on kind of if you believe a functional democracy is possible and kind of how you believe that could work with Black folks at the center of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's an excellent question. All these questions are excellent, actually. But functional democracy. So it always makes me smile when I hear somebody talking about democracy. And every election cycle, I hear people talking about, we have to save our democracy. The soul of our nation is at risk. We got to save this democracy right here. And I just think like when you break it down and think about it, is this really a democracy in the first place? Like when you do a basic Google definition of democracy, it says that ruled by the people. It has all these pillars that it uplifts. A system of government in which people choose their representatives and their legislatures. And supreme power is supposed to be vested in the people. But is that the case now? Has that ever been the case that supreme power has been vested in the people of this country? So we're not even getting back to the times when it clearly wasn't, when there was blatant, outright racism throughout this history. But even right now, like, if power was vested in the people, what would be different in this country right now? Like, I'm asking you and all the listeners too. Like, if supreme power is vested in the people, what would things be like? What would the wages be like? What would jobs be like for everyday people? What would healthcare be like? 80% of Americans say they support Medicare for all, yet our elected officials refuse to even vote on it. So if power is vested in the people, would everybody have healthcare right now? What would housing be like? Would everybody be able to afford a decent house, an apartment, a standalone house, whatever it might be? If power rested in people, would we still be spending $800 billion on this military budget? Would we still be involved in these never-ending wars in Afghanistan and other places that we started 20 years ago that we just have no idea when they're going to be coming to an end? And if power was vested in the people, then how much stimulus money would we have gotten during this pandemic? Like, it's crazy to think that the government told us to stay at home, do not go to work, but didn't give us money to live off of. Got $3,200, $3,200, something like that, and said, take this and good luck with you. So we know that power isn't vested in the people. So we know that this isn't a real democracy. It's a farce. It's an illusion of democracy in the truest sense of the word. And it's a shameful, too. So when we talk about building a functional democracy, man, simple answer is, I don't know if it'll ever happen. But I know we have no choice but to push for it. Like, we have no choice. People have to find the power to demand and push for healthcare for all and other things. And there were certain times throughout the history of our movement where the things that we wanted seemed like they would never happen. Like, could you imagine being a slave in the 1600s, slavery first popped off, thinking you don't never know when this is gonna come to an end? And I'm deep in the South. I have no idea if we'll ever achieve the things we're pushing for. But I have no choice but to try because the present is unacceptable, even though the future is uncertain. So that's where we are now.
I really appreciate that answer just because I feel like every time we ask this question, or at least when somebody turned it around on us and asked us the question, I was like, well, I'm going to answer, but like my answer feels impossible and not realistic and like not something that we can really achieve, even though this is what I think can happen. And I think the important part of that is that we are putting ourselves in that mindset and asking ourselves, well, what would this look like for us? What would it look like to get there? How do we get there? And just asking ourselves and our communities that question over and over, what does this look like for us? How can we get there? Instead of thinking about, well, it's so impossible in the system that we're in right now, just thinking, okay, well, what do we need and how do we get it?
That's right. That's right. In a lot of ways, I look at it like being in a street fight, man. Like, I don't want no trouble. I don't want trouble to find me. But if the fact is, if somebody is trying to knock my head off and step on me and hold me down, I have no choice but to fight back, not knowing how it's going to turn out. So the same way right now, we know that this system is beating our people down. We're getting beat down. Economic inequality is at huge levels, as high as they've been since the Gilded Age. We know that we can't continue working the way we are, and we have no choice but to fight back and but to resist. So to your point, Alyssa, man, we don't know where things are going to turn out, but we know we have to push for something different.
I'm just feeling inspired by those words because it's so easy to get stressed out in the day to day. And just like what Alyssa was saying, it's just the enormity of what we don't have, right? But you said it so many times, we have no choice but to push for it. And I think that's why we all come back to work the next day. Because we know that in our souls, that you said the present is unacceptable. So you just keep going.
My homeboy Umar, man, who used to work with me at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, Umar Muhammad, was talking about a story about how he went. Some of y'all might have heard this story too, but he told me that he went to this bar in Durham. They had a picture, this big, huge burger on the wall, and you got like a free t-shirt and a free meal if you ended up eating that burger. So him and his homeboys got the munchie one day. They all went down there and got those burgers, and they just couldn't finish it. Then all of a sudden, like 2 or 3 weeks later, they were walking down the street at that same bar, and they saw a guy whose picture was on the wall, him being somebody who successfully ate that burger right there. And I was like, hey, bro, how'd you do that? I mean, what did you do? How the hell you eat that whole burger? What's the secret? And he said, I just took it one bite at a time. So we got to look at our work the same way. As big as it seems impossible to challenge this whole huge imperialist system that's been around since forever. But we have to push back one bite at a time. So while Alyssa, I don't know what's going to happen in 50 years from now. I don't know what situation we're going to be in. It seems impossible to change the direction, the trajectory of this country and of this political system. What is possible is coming to a meeting on Wednesday night. What is possible and what is doable is just coming out, helping a couple people pass out a little bit of flyers. So I might not be changing the whole world. I'm not even trying to at this point. I just know I got to engage some other people so I can give an hour to come and do that. And in organizing, too, one of the beautiful things about organizing is that you don't have to know all the answers when you get together. All you have to do is have a commitment to find them, to learn them. So just pulling people together, put your brains together, and take your time and figure it out through trial and error. And that's all we got to do right now. That's all we can do.
Yep.
Organizing work, movement work generally, is hard and it's draining, man. Like even when you got the best intentions, you're not in it as a careerist, you're not just trying to raise your profile, but you're trying to do good work for our people. Man, it's like the system is designed to find every way it can to exhaust you, to pull you out of it, to make you want to just give up and go do something else with your life. Mm-hmm. But there's comfort in knowing that all of our leaders before us felt the exact same way. Like everybody romanticizes on Dr. King now, but the fact is when Dr. King was organizing, Black folks and white folks weren't coming out there to help him too. Less than 50%, probably like 30 or 20% of people were actually out there doing the work with them. And it's the same thing right now. So all we can really do is find ways to pull people together and let those people, when they come together, figure out the answers for themselves. So we find ways to support. Taylor, you might use your communication skills, connect them with different groups to amplify their message, but directly impacted people have to be the ones that figure things out for themselves, and we just help them with the process. So that makes me feel better thinking about it like that too. I remember when I was up there in Greensboro organizing with the Beloved Community Center, they sent us out into a neighborhood and they said, and God, this is a neighborhood, you and this other young woman named Deanna, y'all go out here and do this canvas and just make something happen. I didn't know what the hell I was doing out there. We out there knocking on doors in the summertime. I'm organizing in the purest sense of the form. But then as I talked to people, they would all be like, well, you got some problems with some break-ins out here, man. These little kids ain't got nothing to do, man. These break-ins, kids acting up everything. So all I did from there was just say, all right, well, I'm going to go out and I'm going to rent out the community center up the street. We'll get it for an hour-long meeting on a Wednesday night. Bruh, Marcus, can you come out here to this meeting? Sister Susan, can you come out here to this meeting too? Everybody in the neighborhood said they feel the exact same way. And I would tell people that everybody is saying the same thing. We got 20 people that all feel the same way and they're going to come out to this meeting. In reality, I didn't know who was going to come out to the meeting, but I just told them they all were. So that when we got in there, there was so much energy. Neighbors excited to see each other. People realizing that other people feel the exact same way. They just couldn't wait to throw suggestions and ideas out there. And it was my job as the organizer, and in that situation too, as a communications person too, to just write stuff down, document it all, and share it back out with them, help them stay in touch with each other. So that's all we got to do at a minimum.
Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, I've been thinking back to when you said you used to work in the public defender's office and how difficult that was. I could not imagine. I would not even take that job. I know that I would be probably crying on a daily basis, but, and that, yes, this like organizing and working for the types of groups that we do is exhausting and it is draining, but we also get re-energized from the people that we work with. You know, hearing you speak, you're extremely energized talking about all this stuff. And then just in that story, knowing that you had a room full of people who you were able to inspire and just make them realize that they had each other.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And it's important to realize too, man, you're exactly right about that, Taylor. There's sometimes when doing this work isn't going to energize you, it's going to tear you down and it's going to make you angry and sad as hell. But you still got to find a way to convert that sadness into fuel. So you talking about the public defender's office, that made me think about one prime example. I don't know why I didn't think about this earlier, but I was representing a brother named Hakeem. And it's important to remember that when we're talking about these criminal justice systems, everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people assume sometimes that the most egregious cases are the ones that involve some exonerated DNA evidence of somebody who's been locked up, who they shouldn't have been locked up, but just some real crazy blatant breach of justice. But there are a lot of micro interactions that happen in the justice system that have the exact same effect on our people. So one of my clients, a brother named Hakeem, was up in there. He was put on probation. It was something about drugs or drinking and driving or something like that. Good brother. And when you go on probation, you're told to go through and you get your alcohol and drug treatment courses and you do community service. You come back and you do all that stuff and your probation will end. But if you come back and you haven't done all that stuff, taking your drug course and your alcohol courses to finish your community service and whatever else they tell you to do, then you might go back to jail. So Hakeem came into me that day and he was talking about how Mr. Lab, that was our first time meeting. You know, I got put on this probation a year ago. I went to Love and Respect Recovery House. They're known throughout the hood for the past 15 years for giving services to folks who are trying to overcome their issues. They're doing community service. I'm doing good, Brother Laughing House. I say, Hakeem, that's real good. I appreciate that right there. I get to looking through the list. The court gives you a list of places where you can go to get your alcohol and drug treatment from. These are like certified places. I go to looking through the list, and lo and behold, Love and Respect Recovery House isn't listed up there on that sheet. So I say, damn, Hakeem, man, well, it's not listed, man. You need to go back and hit a different spot up, hit Genesis DWI services or something, and get your stuff done in that. He was like, all right, well, I'm gonna try to make it happen. I want this over with. Month later, he went back and he was doing everything he was supposed to do. He came to check in with me the day before his court date. Hakeem was like, Mr. Lavinas, I've been at Genesis DWI, substance abuse. I done did everything I was supposed to do. I just got two more classes left. And I would have had those classes finished, but I'm waiting on my next paycheck. So if we just get this continued tomorrow, I'll take my paycheck. I'll pay for the classes and I'll get everything done. Because them classes were like $50 a pop too, which is a whole other issue. Come in the next day, Hakeem got on his freshest suit, got a fresh haircut. The suit is too big for him. I could tell it was uncle's suit or something like that. But you couldn't tell Hakeem, he was not fresh. He had some family in there, he was feeling good. Everybody at Love and Respect in his community and his family had been complimenting on how good he had been doing, turning his life around. So he was super proud, super prideful. We get up in there and go in front of the judge, and I tell the judge what the deal is. Hakeem just needs a continuance, just a month, even 3 weeks if need be, and he'll get everything else done. He's just waiting on his last paycheck. Judge said, absolutely not. Hakeem knew what he was supposed to do. His last attorney told him what he was supposed to do. He had that list. I don't want to hear no excuses for him. May Hakeem go and sit on the bench like a little kid while the judge said, I'm going to think about what we're going to do with you. Old white man judge, the oldest judge in the courthouse. So you think about this. Hakeem, this brother who had so much hope that day, his freshest suit, feeling so good about himself, now being told to go sit on the bench in front of the whole courtroom like a little child. So me being a young attorney at the time, I didn't know what to do. I sat over there beside Hakeem because if nothing else, I don't know what to do as a lawyer. I know what to do as a brother, and I just want to be there for him. While I'm sitting there with him, Hakeem is trying his hardest to hold back these tears that he got in his eyes because it's hard for a brother to cry, especially when other people are looking at him. So we held it back. At the end of court, a good hour and a half later, judge called him back up and said, you go do what you're supposed to do. I don't want to see you in here again. Next time, you just go into jail. So we were thankful for that. But as we walked out, Hakeem, it's like the floodgates opened up. He couldn't hold it back no more. So we walking up the hallway, he start crying, saying, forget this haircut, forget this suit, forget this judge, forget all of this right here. And he goes back and he does what he's supposed to do. Next time he comes to court, it's just a regular day. He looks like the same sad, depressed person that everybody is. Gives his paperwork and he goes, I never hear from him again. But that just made me think about this little interaction like that right there. Judge probably thinking I did him a favor. I didn't lock him up. But what type of energy does Hakeem take back home to his family, to his community after that? What type of person is he when we get back, and what does that do for his family? So realizing in the system, in that system that I was working in, when we talk about changing and transforming the system for Black families, we know that in every way, at every turn possible, this system, if you're a Black or a brown person, you're working class or poor, it reminds you that you're one of the weakest people in this country. It reminds you that you ain't got nothing to feel good about, that you shouldn't feel hopeful about anything. Because even when Hakeem was feeling hopeful, it knocked him back down in his place. So at that point, I realized I had to get up out of that job. And as sad as I was, and I'm still sad about that, I used that as motivation, like we talked about, Taylor, feeling down and feeling out. And one last point too, Taylor, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the difference between a revolutionary and between a nonprofit, a do-gooder. A do-gooder will stop doing the work when he no longer feels good about that. A revolutionary is gonna do it whether he feels good or not, because it has to get done, because we're not free yet. So we need a complete revolution. We got to turn this whole country around so that poor people, working class folks, Black and brown folks, working class white folks aren't at the bottom anymore. But we got power to pull ourselves to the top.
That story was super heavy, but I'm glad that you told it for a couple reasons. I think that people need to know and feel those
realities.
Mm-hmm. That
people face every day.
Mm-hmm. And that this man's life, you know, could well have been destroyed if he was sent back to jail. And like you said, you don't even know how he's doing right now. He could be not fine, because he was not shown respect that day after doing so many things that should deserve respect, you know, as well as just every human being should be respected anyway.
That's right. Yes. You think about somebody like Hakeem, and not only that, like, how would he have been? Imagine him going in the other direction if the judge and people in the court would have just said, man, you're doing a good job. Keep it up. Come back next month. You'll be done with all this. Could have created a complete different person based on the simplest interactions like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times, judges and just people, elected officials, people in power in general, they find it easier to wag their finger and tell working class folks, poor folks, why they're wrong, why they're doing bad, why they haven't been able to overcome the odds that are stacked against them, when we all have had odds that we aren't able to overcome. Like, y'all think about how many people that you know said, I want to lose weight this year, but can't put the damn cookies down. People that have said, I want to stop smoking, but can't put the pack of cigarettes down. But then you got the nerve to wag your finger and tell poor people, working folks, why they need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, why they need to be better, but don't have the courage to wag your finger, keep that same energy and point it at the system that you see oppressing our people, with oppression being keeping people in subservience and hardship, especially through the unjust use of authority, which is exactly what we have right now with these police officers, keeping us in suppression and hardship through the unjust use of authority. But so many elected officials don't have the courage to speak up about that. System pulls them in and buys their silence with this $100, $100,000 a year salary and stuff like that. They need to be ashamed of themselves. But it's up to us to hold them ashamed, to hold them accountable like that. And the last point that I'll make on that point too is that elected officials, if nothing else, they respond to consequences. So we done went through, I tried to be nice and talk to elected officials, have one-on-one meetings, posts or pictures with them. And at the end, the only thing that they respond to is consequences. If they fail to act, or if they do not act, how are you going to hold consequences up to them, up to there? And you can't levy consequences against the elected officials unless you have organization, organizational power to do it. That's why we always organize it.
I guess your comment did make me just think about just the very punitive nature of our entire criminal justice system and our lack of focus on rehabilitation in general, and how that's kind of translated to, I guess society in general, how we just have all as a group just lack the taking the understanding that there's gray area in places, and that some things need different understanding than other things. It's not always clear and cut. You broke this rule, or this rule exists, and so we follow it. And so I think it's really just about, we've been talking about this the whole time, but getting out of the mindset that the system puts us in because we're in it, and really challenging it and thinking about how it can be different.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And even going further on that point, like, it's crazy to think that if people want to overcome their substance abuse, or whatever it might be, whatever dependencies they have, like, you can't even go and get that done for free. How are you going to put somebody on probation and tell them you need to clean yourself up, but the classes to get that help cost $50, $100, $200 a pop? At the same time, if that municipality has money like Raleigh does to give this police $111 million in their budget, you can reallocate a piece of that and put it back into the community instead. Because the reality is that we can talk about community safety and public safety. The public isn't safe if you got members of the public who can't overcome some drug addiction, some mental health issue, because they can't afford to get the treatment. And the public is not safe if you got brothers and sisters who don't have a decent house to go back home to or not. And the public is not safe if you got people that's working 40, 50 hours a week full time and still coming back living in poverty because the city refuses to pay them a living wage. That's why this work with Refund Raleigh and others who are trying to divest from police is so important. Because if we don't push for it, then this country, this city, will keep on going in the same direction it's always been and will continue to be run over. So it all goes back to the other point. Like you said earlier, Alyssa, we don't know what the future is going to hold. At times it seems hopeless, but we know we can't continue to go on the way that we've been going on. So something has to shake.
Again, this is a question that we've been asking everybody. So what does it mean to you to be Black in North Carolina?
So to me, what it means to be Black is that we're some of the strongest people on this earth. So you think about, and not just Black folks, but everybody, but you asking about Black, so I'm bigging up my people, Black people right now. But if you think about the fact that we really hit rock bottom before, like, we've been stripped from our own continent, ripped from our culture, ripped from our lands, ripped from our families, physically taken apart from our families, been denied housing and land legally in this country, been denied jobs, been underpaid, been targeted by police, been watched when we go in other neighborhoods. We've had everything brought to bear on us, designed to break us, to snap us. Yet here we stand, here we still are. So to be Black in North Carolina, this country in the South with this history of Jim Crow, Wilmington, the race riots that happened out there, a literal example of them trying to break us when we stood up too tall, even though they got the nerve to tell us to stand up on our own, really just goes to show how strong we are as a people. So I find strength in being Black in North Carolina and anywhere, because no matter how much they might have tried, they haven't been able to break us, and we still fighting, some of the strongest people on this earth.
Well, thank you for that. I really appreciate that answer and everything that you've shared with us today. I think that was our last question, but do you have any final thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners before we go?
Final thoughts would be to follow Democracy NC, follow
and Refund Raleigh. Yeah.
Follow ACLU too. And anytime you see some events that Refund Raleigh is hosting and you want to come out, please, I welcome you to come out there. 90% chance I'll be out there too, so I would love to meet you. If you see light-skinned dude with a big, crazy-looking beard, that's me. Come holler at me. And I'm looking forward to building with you.
Well, everyone, thanks for listening to this conversation today. Make sure you go out there, show up, do something, support Refund Raleigh. And thanks for helping us create a North Carolina that's built by us.
And thanks for listening to this podcast made of, by, and for the people.
Connect with us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at DemocracyNC. Or you can visit our website at democracync.org.